Welcome to the Big Three Podcast, a weekly podcast from Guymie Baptist Church, where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised from our Sunday sermon. Because we believe that one of the spaces where faith can grow is in those small conversations about the big topics.
Well, hello everyone. It's great to be back for another episode of The Big Three. I'm Matt Willis and I'm here with Jessica Baker. How are you, my friend?
Fabulous. How are you?
I'm, you know, kicking goals, yes. Just taking names.
Life. Thriving.
We are thriving.
We are thriving. I actually entered the podcast room shoeless today.
That is true. Yeah. That is true. But really, who needs them? They're just a social construct, aren't they?
They just take time that I don't have.
They just take time and restrict and confine.
Absolutely.
You're just living your best free life.
Yeah, absolutely. That was why I made an intentional decision, not because I was completely rushed.
Beautiful. Well, I'm glad you made it here.
Thank you.
We are halfway through our current series,
yes.
The Courageous Life. Just to kick us off, what's been your kind of big moment, your takeaway in the series thus far?
Some amazing women on this planet.
It has been like who runs the world, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Like,
and look, last week was Abraham. You know, but Abraham had a wife who also had to wait. So just as exceptional as Abraham. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just a series for the women.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had Esther and then Abraham / Sarah.
Yeah.
You know,
mainly Sarah.
She's the one who had to have the baby.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then Ruth was on Sunday.
Yeah.
So yeah.
What a
Beyonce
gal.
Was right. Yeah. Girls run the world.
They do. And we didn't need Beyonce to tell us that. We already knew. But
it's nice to have it affirmed.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, like we said, we are continuing in our series, The Courageous Life, which is something that we have been doing for the last few weeks here at GBC. Mark Rader, our senior pastor, did his second first-person narrative, reflecting on the story of Ruth from the perspective of Boaz. Once again, he decided not to assume the role of
upsetting.
A woman.
It upsetting.
Is. I know. Like, I was just expecting him to come out in the robes, legs for days. really? Like, I think that's what the people wanted, but it's fine. He went the more, you know, I guess, conservative approach, whatever.
Whatever.
It's fine. But a fantastic kind of exploration of Ruth's story and how she lived courageously. For anyone who wants to listen to that either again or for the first time, you can grab that through our GBC Sermon podcast, which is found both on iTunes and Spotify. But as is always the case with the Big Three, we don't want the lessons to end on a Sunday. We don't want the learning to stop from the sermon. We want to keep going. We want to keep that conversation going. And so we've got some Big Three questions that we're going to ask of Mark later in the podcast, just to kind of continue to reflect on who Ruth was and how she lived that courageous life. So to get us started, Jess, why don't you walk us through our Big Three for today?
Question one is, how can 21st century women relate to Ruth's story? Now, this marginalizes half of our demographic.
But of our listeners.
It is something I would like to know.
Listen, and it's an important one. We were having a little bit of a giggle before because we're asking a dude to answer a woman's questions.
Absolutely.
But it's okay. I know that Mark is going to, you know, he's going to be sensitive to that.
Yeah.
And we're going to learn something.
And hopefully, you know, I might have some
you
input.
Might, as a 21st century woman, Jess, you might contribute.
Living and breathing.
To that conversation.
Question two, kindness seems simple. What are the barriers that require us to be kind courageously?
Yeah, boom.
Very nice.
I know. Like, why does it have to be such a big deal? Why can't we just be nice to each other? Why do we need courage
for that? It's
hard
to do.
Is it?
And question three, where are the opportunities for the church to be courageously kind?
Okay. Very so there's nice. Like an individual question and then a collective one.
Love that for
I
us.
I like it for us. Excellent. Well, let's get the man in. Let's get Mark Rader in to the Big Three. How you going, Mark?
I'm good, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm delightful.
Good. Hi, Jess.
Hello.
So, Mark, you've actually not preached a sermon yet in this series.
I know, I've just slacked off, told some stories.
Clearly a fiend for the first person narrative, a slave to it even. Tell us, what does a first person narrative give us that maybe a sermon can't?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things actually. I think, from a preparation perspective, it really forces you to kind of think about what's the point. Mm. You know, like in a more traditional sermon, whatever that might look like, you can generally have a couple of points that you want to make. Mm-hmm. And I find in a first person narrative, or when you're telling a story, even if it's not a first person narrative, you really need to be really, really clear about what your point is, because there's so many jumping off points in a story. People can be distracted by so many elements within the text or the story itself that you got to be really clear about what you're doing. I think it's also really fascinating to prepare a story from the perspective of a character to try to figure out, so what do they know and what can they know and what don't they know and can't know and, you know, all those sorts of things. So it does force you to think about the sermon differently. And I think then when you have, for those kind of listening to them, I think that the reimagined text, even if it's familiar, just I think helps shake up how we normally hear the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of it's a more extreme form of something that I would occasionally do where, you know, if I was looking at a familiar text, I'd actually read it in a completely different translation. You know, like I would use the Message often, because the Message, you know, it's kind of more of a paraphrase than a translation, but it would kind of give you a very different view. You just kind of go, oh, does that text really say that? And kind of drive you back into it. And so I think storytelling, like I had a couple people say to me, you know, I think after the service, you know, that they knew the story, but hearing the story had forced them back into the book.
Yeah, that was my biggest reflection. It made it really tangible and kind of, I can kind of step into this a little bit.
Yeah.
I probably would have related more if there were like multiple costume changes. Probably a dance number in there also.
A song.
Ruth the musical.
Please give the people what they want, Mark. Give the people what they want.
I try to work within the areas that I...
your strengths.
I try to...
You used to be a worship pastor, come on.
Well, I'm not sure that that's... I led worship for a while.
It's a loose title.
It was the period of time known as the three chord worship services. So yeah.
That could be the title of the musical.
I've got to admit, there was that slight uncomfortable moment where clearly the story of Ruth gets a little bit saucy.
Yeah, a little bit saucy.
And I had trauma flashbacks to when my parents gave me the talk. It was like, Dad was giving me the talk all over again. I was like, oh my gosh, why are my parents doing this to me? I was Mark, stop.
And that's my point about jumping off points. So I think the other thing about the story is that for people who are unfamiliar with the story, I think it's a little bit easier to follow than a sermon that is abstracted, you know, where you're talking about kind of points or themes within the story. So I think there's great value all around to do them from time to time.
Loved
so.
It. Would recommend people to go back and listen to it. Can we expect any more first person narratives?
Or there's one more. There's one more. So I'm going to look at the story of Jonathan.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Bit of a change of tactic where we've gone down the male route this time. Yeah.
So I'm still trying to work out exactly the perspective, like who's going to tell the story.
Mm. Is there a woman in the story that...
No, not really. Not this kind. I think it's 1 Samuel 19. It's essentially the passage where Jonathan and David end up parting, and David kind of hides behind the rock, and Jonathan goes to see his dad, and there's this whole kind of, you know, you're no son of mine.
Yeah,
you know,
don't give too much away.
No. Oh my gosh, spoilers! No one wants spoilers.
So anyway, it'll be wrapped around the story of their relationship and the courage that Jonathan shows in that space. So.
Will we wait in bated breath?
Well, there you go. Well, so do I, because there's a lot of work to do. So
no more teasers. Let's get into the big three.
Let's talk about Ruth for a sec. She demands quite a bit of respect. She gets a bit of a reputation when she moves to Bethlehem, is it? That she's quite a well-rounded, delightful woman. Mm-hmm. She's making a lot of sacrifices for her mother-in-law and things. And let's delve into the mind of a 21st century woman, Mark, which may be tricky for you to do as you have zero experience as one. But let's have a little bit of mansplaining here. How can 21st century women relate to Ruth's story? Please shed some light for us.
Well, let me tell you. Nothing like being set up with that first off. So... said the white middle-aged man. So, you know, let's make it even better. I think one of the great strengths of the story of Ruth, and this is probably going to sound like I'm dodging the question,
is that
please let me, is that the application, I think, is is not gender specific in that sense. Like it's not even told as a story of, you know, women, you should be like this. You know, the story, the way it ends, which I didn't actually kind of get to in the first person narrative, is like the money text in it is actually the genealogy at the end, where we find out, like, the surprise ending that, you know, their son Obed gave birth to Jesse, who gave birth to David, the king of Israel. And so that's where you're like, oh, wow. Like, these acts of kindness and these decisions along the way had, like, universal ramifications. You know, what she thought she was just caring for her mother-in-law, she's actually driving forward and enabling the overall plans and purposes of God. Yeah, so you're just like, whoa, you know, so it just kind of gets really big, really fast. And so I think that it's something that I think we're all called to. I think that Boaz and Ruth act as kind of a foil for one another. If you think about it, I'm not sure the poker analogy is the best way to think about it, but, you know, for every act of kindness that Ruth kind of does, Boaz kind of sees it, right? Yeah. Like, he matches it until the end, where she's like, okay, I call. are you really the nice guy that you say that you are? Are you really the God-fearing man that you say you are? And so I think that both of them kind of function as a bit of a, like, both their examples to us about how we go above and beyond in lots of ways. I mean, I think if you wanted to draw a gender specific, you know, component or application for it, like, I think that there's something fascinating in the relationship of Ruth with her mother-in-law, right? Like, I'm sure that mother-in-law jokes existed.
Yeah, not always an easy dynamic.
Not always an easy relationship.
Not for myself, love my mother-in-law, obviously, yeah, as we all do, I'm sure.
On the record.
That's right. But, like, you know, like, that's not a new phenomenon where, like, only in the last 20 years have people gone, oh, you know, daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law don't always get along. Like, that goes way, way back. And so it's not just, like, it would be a completely different story to some degree if it was Ruth's kindness to her mother.
Yeah. That's expected.
Yeah, that's expected.
Yeah, you're not special.
But, you know, wow, okay.
Settle down, Ruth. You're not getting a trophy.
You've heard it from a 21st century woman. So, you know, I think in that sense, there's something about, shall I say, some of those uniquely, female relationships where that kind of kindness provides, you know, a bit of an example. I would say that you could flip it, you know, anyway though, right? Mm. So, but I think that would be one. I think that there may also be potentially some interesting points of reflection around women and childbearing and their identity. Because in the story, when Ruth's husband dies without having had any children and she decides to go with Naomi, like, it's fascinating. She kind of makes this almost a wedding vow to her mother, right? Like, your people, my people, your God, my God, where you die, I'll die. Mm. But ironically, she's basically saying, I'm never going to get married again. Mm. Right? Like, there's no way that's going to happen. And so when she arrives and, you know, the situation with Boaz turns and kind of comes to light, even in the story, like, if you read it through, as soon as Ruth kind of leaves the threshing floor, I think she's referred to once more, but she disappears from the story. She's no longer an active participant in it. So when, you know, Boaz made love to his wife, the Lord enabled her to conceive. She gave birth to a son and they gave him to Naomi. She just completely recedes in some regards because the child is not kind of legally hers. Mm. Like, she's included in Jesus's genealogy, but, like, I don't think she would have been, like, I have no idea who Obed would have called mum, right? But, you know,
it does seem messy.
It does seem messy.
It's a blended family.
But I think that there's something in that, you know, and when you consider how important childbearing was in that context, like in that social system. Mm. You know, like, I think that there would have been a slight question mark over Ruth in the fact that her first marriage ended with no children. Mm. I mean, you know, what sort of a couple can't have children? Mm. Right? You know, like in that context, oh, they're, you know, under the hand of God, and then her husband died. Well, of course, she's a Moabitess. What do you expect? Yeah. Right? So there would have been a question mark in that culture and context. And for her to then willingly say, I'm going to have a child without having a child, right? Like, I am going to be a surrogate. I'm going to get pregnant and then give the child to.
Mm.
So has she become a mom? Yeah, yes. Mm. Was she a mom in that social context? Not really.
Mm.
And so I think there's something potentially in that for women in the 21st century to consider her example as it relates to identity as God-fearing women who seek to be kind rather than seeking their own identity. That would be the other place that I think you could potentially have some kind of gendered reflections, if that makes some sense. I think the joke was that you should probably add a few words here as well. But like, those would be the places where I think there'd be a kind of a reasonable place where you could go, women in the room, let's talk about these things. Those kind of feminine relationships and identity in relationship to childbearing. Because while childbearing is not quite the same, doesn't have the same social weight as it would have had in Ruth's day and age, there's still...
Oh, yeah, women definitely feel... I don't know, pressure to have that kind of dream for themselves.
Yeah. And so, like, I think those would be the two places. I don't know.
I think it just both examples speak really strongly to Ruth's selflessness that she would, like, she doesn't have to have that kind of relationship with her mother-in-law. Like you said, it's not her mother. And the other daughter-in-law kind of went back to start another life for herself. And the same thing with a child. She probably really wanted a child, and her husband died, so she didn't get that opportunity. So to have a child for someone else is huge.
Mm.
So I think they both just speak into how amazing Ruth was, really. Mm. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the even the surrogate piece, I mean, you know, that's probably not a great word to use because we have modern connotations for what that is. But the impression that you get is that Ruth became Boaz's wife.
Mm.
But only for the purposes of providing an heir for Naomi.
So what was that relationship as well?
So there's we don't even, like, Boaz could have been married, right? So like it's called Levirate marriage in, I think it's in Leviticus or Deuteronomy, but basically talks about like if a man dies without children, it was the duty of his brother-in-law.
Yeah, that's right.
To marry the widow or to take her as his wife, but to provide a child for the dead man's widow. And she was a second wife, but she was a second wife.
Mm.
So there was no sense of, oh, I've got, you know, I've just found another woman I'm in love with. It's like, it's my sister-in-law. Mm. Like, I'm the only reason we're doing this is for my brother, right? And for his namesake. So, you know, she would have had to have been married, right? She couldn't have just kind of, you know, found somebody to have a kid with so that, you know, her mother wouldn't. Yeah. So I think that, you know, while you get the impression that Boaz and Ruth are well suited for each other, he was much older than she was, may have been married already. We're not told. Even if he wasn't, the marriage wasn't so that they could build their family.
Mm.
And we don't hear any more of that about, you know, and then, you know, years later, Ruth had a whole bunch of kids with Boaz and they lived happily ever after. And, you know, like, we don't hear any of that. So it's just like she had one kid, gave it away, and was married to Boaz for the rest of her days.
But what that looks like,
yeah,
we'll never know.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah, I think you're right. I think that it does highlight the kindness. So yeah.
I think what we can all agree as 21st century women is don't walk into a place where men have been heavily drinking and working all day and then just like go to sleep there. That was a dumb move. Worked out well for Ruth because Boaz seemed to be a nice guy. But
it's fascinating in the story because in the story in the Hebrew, they stop referring to Ruth and Boaz. It's just the man and the woman. And there's a sense of tension because it's dark. It's on the far side of the grain pile. This Moabitess has shown up. It's the days when the judges ruled, right? So we don't expect anything good to happen in this story. And while Boaz and Publix have been all, hey, the Lord bless you and the Lord bless you. And yeah, by all means, just reaping my fields, you know, like all that kind of stuff. And Ruth's been like exceptional. Now they're in the dark, out of the public spotlight. There is a sense in the story where I think the storyteller wants us to think, oh no. Like, is this going to go all judges on us?
Yeah.
Like, is this where we find out that she really is a Moabitess in the worst sense of the word, and where Boaz is just like everyone else in Israel that seems doing whatever they see right? Like, is this just going to get ugly?
Mm.
And the fact that she then asks this stunning question of kindness and Boaz goes, yeah, I'll pay that. Like, I will do everything you ask. It kind of should take us a little bit by surprise, you know, that kind of, oh, wow, they're really as godly as they appear in daylight. Mm. Wow. Okay. Did not see that coming, you know?
So. Yeah, don't follow that example.
Yeah, whether you should be testing it that way, gamble. I don't know. But yeah. So.
Well, before we continue to go into all the different aspects of Ruth's story, let's move on to question two. So, Mark, it seems to me that kindness is pretty simple, and yet one of the defining aspects of Ruth's story is how she was courageously kind, that her actions of kindness required courage in her to kind of see it come to fruition. Mm-hmm. So what are the things in our everyday life, what are the barriers, the obstacles, whatever you want to call them, that require us to be courageously kind?
Mm. When you consider, so I already mentioned that like Ruth and Boaz kind of provide us like a foil for each other, but they also have other foils, right? So Orpah, Ruth's sister-in-law, and the nearer kinsman redeemer, who in the text is just Mr. So-and-so, basically. He's just unnamed. Both of them provide a bit of a foil for the two main characters. And what many commentators point out is that neither Orpah or the nearer kinsman redeemer are condemned or criticized by the narrator. And the reason is that they both did the right thing.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so the nearer kinsman, when Boaz said the land's for sale, he was like, I'll buy it. You're like, okay, so he's willing to redeem the land at cost to himself in order to keep it in the family. Like, that's good. That's what you can ask.
Mm.
The next stage, though, of then taking Ruth, that additional cost, that additional risk, right, the additional component of that, which interestingly is not connected in the law. So you have Levirate marriage and you have redemption of land, but they're not connected as they are in the story, which suggests to some commentators that what we have here is kind of a local expression of the law, you know, but no one seems surprised by it. Like this fellow doesn't go, what, that's unfair. There are two different texts in the Old Testament. You know, like, he doesn't do any of that. He just goes, oh, fair enough. I didn't realize that. I can't do it. So he's willing to do the good, but he's not willing to go above and beyond.
Mm.
Orpah is the same, right? So when Naomi sends them both home or tries to send them both home, she basically says, like, may the Lord bless you. Mm. Like, may the blessing of God be on you because you've been really kind to me.
Mm.
You've shown love and faithfulness to my husband, to your husbands. Like, thank you. And Orpah then goes, no, I'm not leaving you. And eventually Naomi persuades her basically by saying, you're never going to get married if you come with me. Mm. Like, that's it. And so she goes home. And again, willing to do what is good, but doesn't go above and beyond, right? So yeah. Ruth's kindness and Boaz's kindness, their loyalty, their faithfulness, their love, is kind of above and beyond.
Mm.
And so I think when we then think about what that example means for us, I think in both instances, it's that above and beyond component, right? That's the edge. I think often our kindness to others is boundaried, and maybe I'm just speaking about myself, but is boundaried by my immediate capacity.
Yeah.
Right? So I'd like to think that all things being equal, I will generally be kind to people within my capacity, which I suppose is nice enough. But both Orpah and the nearer kinsman redeemer, while they're not criticized, don't get much cred.
Yeah.
Right? Both of them are kind of like, yeah, you could be like them and that would be okay. But like, who wants to be Orpah? right? You know, like, you know, we all want to be Ruth, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, if those are the two examples, well, I don't want to be like the Orpah in my life where it's just like, yeah, I was nice. I kind of did not the bare minimum, because neither of the other two characters do just the bare minimum, you know, to repurchase the land, to care for your mother-in-law. That was a little bit above and beyond.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that we have to be asking ourselves is, where does our kindness call for more than is socially acceptable?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, where's the cost to us? Because once there's a cost, that's when there's some courage needed. Yeah. You know, I mean, I quite enjoyed like telling the story from the perspective of Boaz and just kind of acknowledging that like Ruth's kindness took far more courage than Boaz's. Right? So for Boaz to go and talk to a Moabitess in the field would have been a little bit of a risk to his reputation. His favoritism of her, you know, if there were other poor people, I mean, they weren't allowed to go and take water from the jars. They weren't allowed to, you know, harvest among the sheaves. They weren't the ones who were having stuff dropped in front of them all day long, you know. So like there would have been, you know.
Oh, I dropped it. Yeah, some wheat and grain.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, oh no.
Into your basket.
Yeah, more or less. You know, and so there would have been a few risks to his reputation in that sense, which takes a little bit of courage, but not the same amount. Mm. And similarly, when he, you know, the investment, you know, of land and wife and son, and then kind of the loss of those, you know, that required some courage in the provision of God and stuff moving forward. But it wasn't equal to Ruth's courage of, I'm just going to marry a stranger, either this older stranger or some other stranger in order for my mother-in-law to be provided for. But I think there are degrees of courage required, but I think it comes where there's a cost. Where's the cost to us? Does this kindness require more from me than what I'm just able to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Without thinking,
you know. You know, and again, not to downplay what Orpah or the nearer kinsmen were willing to do, but like, you know, will you buy the land? Yeah, I'll buy the land.
Yeah.
You know, because if I buy the land, it stays in the clan, but like it's mine. I just kind of, I'll make my money back or whatever the case might be. It was kind of an easy ask. So I think for me, that seems to be the place where courage is required.
Mm. I think, you know, that's really good. Because I think, you know, kindness can be reactive, but for it to actually be like something that we consider, then it means that it is going to require more.
Yeah.
If we're going to be intentional about our courage, then we need to our kindness.
Yeah.
Then it does require kind of forethought and a consideration of like, where is the threshold for me? Like, where will the boundary be? Will I put a boundary on this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And at what point do I kind of call it? That's a far more kind of like, that's a pretty confronting question that you ask of yourself. Like, because I think we'd all like to kind of go, yeah, I'm kind, and I'd be kind, and would take an opportunity to be kind. But if you're having an honest conversation with yourself about like, but to what, like,
how often does it cost me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you start to kind of go, oh, actually, yeah, a bit of courage is going to be required in this situation.
Yeah. I think that's pretty helpful. I mean, the other element I think within the story of Ruth is, for both Ruth showing kindness to her mother-in-law, kind of a trickier relationship. I mean, you know, when Naomi shows up in Bethlehem, she goes, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," which means bitter. I've come back empty. Oh, this is my daughter-in-law. Like she's right there. Yeah. I've come back empty. The Lord's hand is heavy upon me. Oh, this is Ruth. You know, you're like, you know.
Like, classic mother-in-law shenanigans. Well,
do you know what I'm saying? Like, thanks, Mom. Like, I'm right here, you know. And so there is an element that this was not just, you know, that this wasn't this lovely, kind.
Yeah, it wasn't,
you know,
easy.
Not necessarily, you know. And again, for Boaz, you know, like, she's a Moabitess.
Yeah.
Okay, what do we do with that? You know, and so there is an element of also kindness to those to whom you might not first show kindness.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a kindness of Boaz to his close friend.
Yeah.
You know, it's Boaz's kindness to Naomi, a relative.
Yeah.
But a relative.
Who's been away for however
10 years,
long.
Yeah. You know, and who is not his relative. Like it's, she's his relative through marriage to Elimelech.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, like there's just a few things going on in that space. So I think that's the other question of what does it, you know, to whom am I showing kindness? Mm. Is it just the people that I really like?
Yeah.
The people who are most like me or the people who can pay me back, right? You know, which is, I think sometimes, you know, part of our, I think it's a similar question to generosity. Who are we being generous to? Yeah. If we're just being generous to people that we like.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good. It's not a bad thing. But I think the courageous generosity is, you know, beyond that. And I think, you know, your point about intentionality is really significant. You know, there's a sense in the threshing floor scene where Naomi's idea is just that she wants Ruth to kind of, I don't know, hit on Boaz or something and either marry him so she can marry him or get set up with one of his sons or cousins or like, and Ruth seems to take matters into her own hands. Right. So she's thought about it. So she doesn't just kind of come in and say, hey, marry me because you know, I'm a woman of noble character. Mm. She basically shows up and says, let's do this for my mother-in-law. And I don't think that doesn't appear to be Naomi's motivation.
Yeah.
Like Naomi's just trying to do something kind for, for Ruth. And Ruth's like, yeah. No. This is still about you. Like we're going to make this about you. Mm. So that intentionality is quite significant.
Nice. All right. Well, let's now move on to question 3.
So question 3, I think, is huge, and there's so many opportunities for us as a church to display like Ruth's kind of kindness. But can you give us some specifics of where are the opportunities for our church to be courageously kind?
You know, the corporate application is a little bit different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
I think the first thing that springs to mind for me is if we're going to emulate Ruth's courage and her kindness and the love that she shows, the kind of the hesed, the Hebrew word for that kind of the covenant faithfulness, I think there's something really significant in the fact that Ruth comes from outside in. I think one of the challenges for the church is that we're still very much waiting for people to come to us, you know? And the fact that Ruth leaves her family, her father, all that's comfortable, all that's known, all that's familiar, and makes her mother-in-law's people her people and her mother-in-law's God her God. Mm. And
people that don't particularly like her.
Yeah.
She's got a bad rep from
the start. Like to do that, you know, like she would have been in a very, you know, a dangerous situation from time to time.
Yeah.
And I think that, but
well, I did think about that, like the whole, like her even just going into the fields and there being workers there and like, and she's just there by herself, like,
and taking more grain than every other poor person who doesn't like
her. Well,
Well, and it's, you know, it's the time of the judges, right? And so, if you read the last two chapters of Judges, like it's a nightmare.
Mm.
Like, you know, there's rape and murder and kidnapping. Mm. And like, it's just,
wholesome people.
Oh, far out. Like the closing chapters of Judges, and then the very next book is Ruth.
Yeah.
So you've just kind of come through the trauma of the end of Judges, and then Ruth opens with "In the days when the judges ruled," and you're like, "Oh, I cannot, I can't handle another story like that."
Mm.
And then you learn about, and it's a story about a widow and her daughter-in-law who's also a widow, who's from Moab. Oh, this is just
like, this is a hot mess.
Let's skip ahead to Samuel, like far out. So there is that danger, like, and even. I couldn't really draw it out on Sunday, but like Boaz says to Ruth, stay here because in another field you might be harmed.
Mm.
And says to his men rather, don't touch her.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself,
which speaks that there might have been an assumption that they would have, and that even just the casual nature of like, hey guys, so like don't do that.
Yeah.
Like is like it would have been accepted if they had.
And Naomi is the one who says, yeah, follow in his fields, like because someplace else you'll get hurt.
Mm.
You're like, so she knew that that was on the cards, you know?
There's risk involved.
Oh, like, man.
And I think to come back to your point of how, you know, we're constantly, the church is kind of constantly saying, well, you come to us, you come to our buildings, to our services.
There's no risk for us.
There's no risk for us, but there's huge risk for someone who, you know, for lack of a better term, is like on the outside who doesn't, you know, understand faith, is new to faith, might feel like their own journey excludes them from faith. Like they're holding all the risk. They're the Ruth in this scenario.
And I think, you know, we need to flip it and we need to be the Ruth.
Yeah.
You know, now of course, you know, there seems to have been enough common cultural background, right?
Yeah.
You know, for her to kind of make the transition. It wouldn't have been completely and utterly new.
Yeah.
But you can imagine that the language or dialect would have been different, that the obviously the religious ceremonies would have been different. Like even just the festivals. Mm. I mean, the Moabites didn't celebrate Passover. Moabites didn't celebrate the Festival of Booths.
Yeah.
Right. Because that wasn't part of their story. So there would have been all sorts of things for her to get used to, all sorts of blunders that she probably made.
Yeah.
Right. Like all of those sorts of things. And so I think that there's something quite powerful in thinking about what would it mean for us to take the stance of Ruth to demonstrate. You know, because Ruth could have said to Naomi, listen, I'm more than happy to show you kindness and commit my life to caring for and serving you, but you have to stay in Moab.
Mm.
Now, culturally, she wouldn't have had that kind of say, right? She was the daughter-in-law, right? Mm. But that could have been, right, her statement. Orpah, that might have been part of her story. Incidentally, I think we assume that Orpah, under the blessing of God, lived happily ever after. Like, went back home, got married, had a stack of kids, you know, like, you know, the whole kind of bit. But, you know, if Naomi had stayed, I would have cared for her.
Mm.
But for Ruth to go, I think there's something really substantial in that. Mm. And learning the ways of another people, of learning their language, of learning the way of living, of learning, right?
Mm.
I mean, even, you know, I think there probably would have been similar inheritance laws in Moab, in terms of, you know, next of kin and inheritance and those sorts of things. But she still had to figure out, like, you know, she still had to figure out the redemption of land and the Levirate marriage piece. And kind of do enough thinking about it to kind of put the pieces together to say, so if I ask him to marry me on behalf of, right? So she's like, she's been asking the questions and then she's seeking to show kindness in the language of the host, of her hosts, rather than saying, oh, well, now I'm going to be kind to you in a Moabite way.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for, you know, I think the first stage for the church then is to be a little bit more focused on going and listening and learning and being the one who's uncomfortable and being the one who doesn't understand what's going on and being the one who asks the dumb question and the one who doesn't get the in joke and write all that stuff in order that we can then, when it comes to showing kindness, we can show kindness where it's required, where it's wanted and where it's going to make the biggest impact.
Yeah. I think that piece that you just said, like she could have given kindness in a Moabite way. I think, you know, that's probably one of the the trip ups that the church has had over history is like, well, we're just being kind in a Christian way. It's like, oh, like if, you know.
Not received well.
It's not been received well, Jess. No, it has not. And it's because, like, you're assuming far too much. You're assuming a specific role, a specific kind of understanding. And you're not actually meeting people where they're at in their their journey and in what's happening for them and their own understanding of all of that. Yeah. I think like that kind of to show kindness the way someone
needs it to
needs
be shown.
It and identifies for themselves that they need that.
Yeah. And again, that's what
really
Ruth,
powerful.
Yeah, that's what Ruth does. She's like, "What does my mother-in-law need? Well, right
needs
now,
a kid.
She needs an heir.
Yeah."
Because her husband's dead, her sons are dead. no children, no grandchildren.
Yeah.
So for her to have that security moving forward, this is what I can do. Mm. And then she goes and does it. So, yeah. But I think, you know, for the church, I think the first step of courage is to be the stranger.
Yeah.
And to do the hard work of listening,
yeah,
engaging, learning, before we then show kindness. Now, you know, it's not like the world in which we live is completely, you know, unknown to us.
Yeah.
We could probably do some things that were kind, you know,
yeah,
without doing a lot of market research, so to speak. But, you know, I think that there is a real element for us of really reaching out to our community and with kind of some courage to not know and to, you know, challenge some of our assumptions, you know, because I'm sure Ruth had assumptions about the Israelites, just like the Israelites had assumptions about Moabites, you know. And so your assumptions are challenged, the things that you believe are challenged, you know. So I think that's where the courage would lie. Mm.
Do you think we're set up for that kind of going out to be courageously kind?
I think that we are. Mm. I just don't think we leverage it particularly well. So I think we still are too focused on what happens in a church building.
Yeah.
On a Sunday or a whatever the day of the week is. But the reality is, like, we are pretty embedded in our culture, right? Like, in terms of when you're not at church,
yeah,
you know, people are doing,
where are you? Yeah.
People are doing the same things that everyone else is doing. Yeah. So there's ample opportunity. You know, I think at least for, you know, say most Baptist churches, we're not part of a Christian ghetto. Right. Mm. Where we only do business with other Christians and only talk to other Christians. And like we have wider relationships, which brings both challenges, but some really significant opportunities. So I think that we are, I just don't know that we're utilizing that setup to really kind of go, hey, mission's not in here. It's out there. Mm. And let's equip people to think through the issues and to, yeah, you know, all those sorts of things.
Oh man, what a challenge to end on. Yeah. Yeah. As always, Mark, a sheer delight to have you on the Big Three.
Thank you very much.
Just to like drop some bombs on us.
Bit of mansplaining, loved it all.
We had everything this episode.
You don't often get permission to do that. So let me explain why. Thanks,
well,
guys.
Well, we look forward to the third and final installment of a three-part first-person narrative.
All right. Look forward to it as well. See you guys.
Yeah. All right, Jessica Baker.
Matthew Willis.
We went everywhere.
We did.
We talked about women's issues.
Love a women's issue.
Which, can I just point out, like, and to my question.
Can,
like,
you mansplain
what,
a bit more?
No, what stood out to me is, like, I think Mark was right in the universal nature of Ruth. Yeah. I think it's actually a very one-dimensional viewing of the story to kind of go, well, this is a woman's tale.
Yeah.
Like,
Ruth has something to share with everyone.
Yeah, yeah, with everyone. Yeah. Men need to be like Ruth a little bit.
Absolutely.
Maybe a little bit more. But what was your takeaway for it all?
I think the like sacrifice to yourself is huge. You know, when I think of being kind, from the church's point of view, as a Christian in a church, like, oh, I can give a little bit of money here to someone who needs it, or, but that doesn't cost me anything. Mm. How many times in my life have I been courageously kind? Probably not that many at all. And there's so many opportunities. Like, we just have so much.
Yeah.
Like, I'm probably not going to be a surrogate for anyone who asked for it. I didn't mind pregnancy. You know, birth was cool, but that's probably not my vibe.
Birth is cool.
I mean, I don't want to go too in depth of how amazing and empowering and delightful it was, but but as a church, like, what are we doing for people who are different from us, for people who are going to hurt our reputation, who are going to take time away from us, or that we just have to sit and have a really like yucky conversation with, or whatever. Like, I'm just not doing that.
Yeah. It seems that we keep coming out of these episodes with a mirror being held up to ourselves and we've just kind of got to take a good long look. And it is exhausting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of how we're not these amazing women.
It's true. Well, no doubt we will continue to need to reflect as we move throughout this series. I think we've got two more weeks. Belinda Lakeland, our evangelism coordinator, is preaching this coming Sunday.
Is she doing a skit?
She's not doing a first person narrative, though. She's preaching on Isaac. So, boom.
Delightful.
It's a whole thing.
Maybe she can come and mansplain us. The opposite woman-splain us about Isaac.
Right on. Nice. All right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see. And we'll talk about it next week on The Big Three. See you later, Jess.
See ya.
If you want to be a part of the conversation, head to slido.com, a live forum where you can submit your own questions or upvote someone else's. Then listen out in new episodes for the answer. Check our show notes for the Slido code. Today's episode was in response to the sermon preached at Guymie Baptist Church during our Sunday services this past weekend. You can listen to that message again through our regular GBC Sermons podcast. You can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, where we hear the stories of faith from those within our GBC community. You can find both of those podcasts on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks for joining us for this week's Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember, there's no thought too small, no question too big.